This is the Quality News Network. Al-Qaeda is the number one suspect in today's assassination of former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. According to officials with the Bush administration and a watchdog group on global democracy, both sources say that Al-Qaeda has the most to gain from Bhutto's demise. Al-Qaeda's Taliban ally, who publicly threatened Bhutto, is another potential suspect. Today's assassination of the former prime minister is being condemned around the world. Just minutes after completing her first official political rally this morning, Bhutto was fatally shot in the chest and neck. The lone assassin then blew himself up, killing at least 20 other people and injuring dozens. Bhutto led the most popular political party in Pakistan, a pro-democracy group expected to win parliamentary elections set for January 8th. In reaction to her death, angry Pakistanis have taken to the streets, throwing rocks at police, setting cars on fire, and blocking streets. Police fired on one crowd, killing two people in the city of Kharpur, and in Peshawar, tear gas and batons were used to break up riots. Bhutto's body is already en route to the town of Sukkur, Pakistan, for burial next to her famous father, also a former prime minister of Pakistan, who formed the Pakistan People's Party. Bhutto's burial will be conducted sometime within the next 24 hours at the family's ancestral gravesite. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for Pakistani peace and national unity in reaction to her death. President Bush blamed extremists trying to undermine Pakistan's democracy. In San Francisco, the city's zoo director acknowledged that the wall around the tiger pen is well below the height recommended by an accrediting agency for zoos across the U.S. At just 12.5 feet high, the wall needed to be another 4 feet higher to meet the minimum recommended height of 16.4 feet. Near Seattle, Washington, two suspects accused in the shooting deaths of 6 members of the same family made their first court appearance today. Planning to file a federal lawsuit, the National Rifle Association is seeking New Orleans residents whose guns were seized by authorities in the midst of the chaos following Hurricane Katrina. And more U.S. law enforcement officers were killed this year than have died on duty since 1989. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
As the world moves to the Internet for marketing, promotion, sales, and communications, it is important to stake out your presence, your business, or yourself in an effective way. The people at Byte Technology know how to define your best self on the web so that people who know you and those who will want to can get a clear picture of who you are and what you have to offer. Byte Technology will design your website so that you will attract new customers and keep your current client base engaged and informed. As McLuhan said, the medium is the message. And never was that more true than in the new Internet commerce world. Whatever your business, selling products or services, to the general public or to a niche market, you need a presence that smart people, the people who make the best customers, can find quickly and understand immediately. Byte Technology will custom produce such a site for you. Byte Technology. See the difference at byte-technology.com or call 831-656-9178.
More than 3 million American taxpayers will have to wait until February to receive their refund checks. The IRS is placing the blame on Congress and their late fix of the alternative minimum tax. Congress put a one-year freeze on growth of the AMT last week, which shields some taxpayers, some who make just $65,000 a year. Volvo is recalling 125,000 trucks sold in the U.S. World's second largest truck manufacturer says there's a serious problem with the main circuit breaker in the lighting system. Apple and 20th Century Fox will soon announce an agreement permitting consumers to rent the film studio's recent releases by downloading them from Apple iTunes Store. Warner Music Group has agreed to sell its music on Amazon.com's digital music store. Warner had resisted putting its songs into MP3 format. The agreement increases the number of MP3s for purchase through Amazon to more than 2.9 million. Light sweet crude oil currently trading at $96.62 a barrel, gold at $831.80 an ounce. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 192 points to end at 13,359. The Nasdaq dropped 47 points to end at 2676. The S&P 500 off 21 points at 1476. And there's always more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Because we're Gather around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
America and good morning world. Welcome to book chapter and verse 93 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold and welcome to the LGBTQQS version of Conversation Radio exclusively on the listener supported Head On Radio Network. Thank you. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is in fact Thursday, December 27th. So if you are listening on a Thursday evening at approximately 9:06 p.m. Eastern Time, you are listening to a live show, and you are welcome to phone in and talk to myself. And in the second hour of the show, you are welcome to call in and talk to myself and the guest, whom I'll tell you more about in just a minute. The telephone numbers are 877, this is the toll-free line, by the way, 877, the number 4, head-on. That's 877-4 head-on, or if you have unlimited long distance, please use that and save the studio a nickel or a buck. That's area code 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the breaks or when we're running music. Did you notice? I remembered to plug in the microphone this evening. I wrote a big sticky note to myself, plug in microphone, then connect. It works well. I'm told that the audio quality is much better when I have a microphone plugged in. Our guest this evening is Isaiah Brokenleg. Isaiah will join us at 10 p.m., and Isaiah is a gay man. He's a Lakota. He's from the Lakota tribe. He was raised in the traditional Lakota culture, where he learned that queer people should be honored and treated with respect. Imagine that. Isaiah will be talking to us about what it's like to be a two-spirited person in the Lakota Nation. We'll be talking about the recent news that the Lakota are seceding from the United States, and we'll be talking about a heroic act that he did. In fact, it was all in the news. We all know this story. I'll wait and broach that later for you and tell you what that was. But he's quite a hero, too. But he's a soft-spoken man. I don't think he'll want to present himself in that way. However, it is a fact. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests as well as to the audio archives from the past shows. You'll find those organized in a calendar format. You'll find links there to the chat room, which is active as we speak. And you'll find links to the Head On Radio Network main site, where you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, listener-supported Head On Radio Network, of which I am only a very small part. If you're able, please stop by headonradionetwork.com, and you'll find a PayPal button there, and you can help keep the packets passing and the streamers streaming and the old guys plugging in their microphones on cue. There are also links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate music that you hear on the show. Speaking of music, we have some unusual musical tracks this evening. The music that we run we'll try to get to during the first hour because our guests will be joining us the second hour of the show. These tracks are going to be unexpected. They're not normally what I play, but I think that you'll really enjoy them. And, in fact, you might even be able to dance to them. Oh, my stars. It has been weather just strange here. Today it was almost 80, and I think tonight it's only going down into the lower 60s, so it was another short-sleeve weather day, and this is practically February here. People who say that the globe isn't heating up don't live where I live. We're absolutely not having winter here, absolutely not having winter here at all, and even Doggy is concerned because normally when there's a you know, hard freezes that happen from time to time, it tends to kill off the flea population. But we're having to do the, you know, the frontline flea drops all through the December, and you know, it's there's no let up from battling the fleas. They're just everywhere. I mean, you walk outside and they're just around. They're not in the house. We keep that under control, but fleas are everywhere. They are on deer and all kind of little rabbits and bunnies and things that hop through the yard. You just never know what's coming up next. Let's see. Where do we begin? Let's see. First thing to do is put the glasses on. Ah, yes, I can see much better now. Greta Christina's blog did a wonderful section today on the choices for the log closet Republicans. And she writes an article which is very insightful. Which is worse? These are your choices, log closet Republicans. These are your choices, Huckabee or Giuliani. Now, you realize, as we've talked about many times in the past, that Giuliani has been the current darling of the log closet Republicans, and I assume still remains so. But it looks like he has a snowball's chance in hell. But basically, the article asks the log cabin Republicans, which is worse? You know, where are you going to come down on this voting issue? And if you remember, we quoted Mike Huckabee the other day saying, unless Moses comes down with two stones and tablets from Brokeback Mountain to tell us something different, we need to keep our understanding of marriage. Then we have Rudolph Giuliani saying, it's the axe. A-C-T-S. It's not the A-X-E. It's the acts. It's the various sex acts that people perform that are sinful. It's not sinful just to be a homosexual, but you can't do anything. So, anyway, Greta starts with a comparison about Huckabee, which is just brilliant. She said, I could go with Huckabee's snarky, smirky, Brokeback Mountain reference and go on about how Brokeback Mountain has become the new Adam and Steve, you know, regarding jokes and what have you. But the main point is, she says, how inappropriate could it be for him to reference Brokeback Mountain in that reference? I mean, did he even see the movie? The way he puts it, he must think it's a ringing endorsement for gay people to deny their sexuality and get into heterosexual marriage. The whole point of the movie was that gay people staying in the closet ruins lives. And not just their lives, but the lives of their wives and their families and everyone around them. So for him to say, you know, Moses coming down from Brokeback Mountain and saying that in support of, quote, traditional marriage, points to the fact that he's completely clueless. And then you've got another choice, your Giuliani choice, ye log cabin Republicans. Now, Giuliani, of course, has been twice divorced and three times married. He's an adulterer. You want to get right down to it. This man is lecturing gay people on their sinful sex lives. It's the act. It's the act. It's not just being a homosexual. That's okay. It's the act. You know, oh, my stars, please. So what do you think is worse, craven hypocrisy or just bigotry? The hypocrite being, of course, Giuliani, and the bigot being Huckabee. I've begun calling him Huckabeast because he truly... I know somewhere in his body, on his wrinkled Republican body, there's the mark of the beast. I just know it. 666 tattooed on his Republican ass. But in any case, the writer, Greta, writes that she doesn't believe for a second that Giuliani actually thinks that homosexuality is a sin or the sex act. He supported civil unions and he supported domestic partnerships when he was the mayor of New York. And, you know, everyone knows this. We've talked about it endlessly, that when his second marriage was breaking up, he moved into an apartment with two of his gay friends, and he stayed with them while the second marriage was, you know, going down the toilet and it was spinning rapidly. He also did a Victor Victoria drag show with Julie Andrews, no less. And now he's not the most enlightened person on the planet when it comes to LGBT issues, but he doesn't have anything against it personally. The thing is that his giant move to the right is purely political. He wants to be the president. He is a hypocrite. So he thinks he has to suck up to the far right to accomplish that goal. And, of course, gay bashing is the quickest and the easiest possible way to do that. Now, Huckabee, or Huckabeast, on the other hand, his vitriol, he means every single word of it. He is a real, true-life bigot. As I said at the beginning of the article, which is better, a bigot or a hypocrite? His record speaks endlessly about his bigotry. It's, of course, comes from the old fundamental. He was a Baptist preacher, as we've talked about before. Remember, you notice that all of the sermons have vanished. We know what he said in the 10.5 years when he was the governor of Arkansas. There are many reports from folks in Arkansas. I'll get into a little bit of that in a minute about how he handled some issues down there. But we have no record of any of his sermons. They've conveniently vanished. And I must tell you that that church had, you know, all sorts of... I just know this for a fact. Hell, the little country church that I go out to has a very high-quality sound system. We burn CDs as the preacher speaks. We record cassettes simultaneously. You know, all this stuff is documented forever and ever. It goes on the church website. But somehow, some way, this little Baptist church, and I think it was probably a large Baptist church, one of the truth, somehow lost all of these sermons. And just imagine that. I would love to hear some of his, wouldn't you? They're carefully hiding that stuff. So which is better, a closed-minded true bigot or a hypocrite? And she goes on to point out that from a purely ethical standpoint, she thinks that the true believer, the bigot, has a stronger position because even though bigotry is evil and it's harmful, at least it's sincere. It's not, you know, simply for selfish gain. It's internal evil. But from a practical standpoint, she points out that she'd probably rather the hypocrite be in public office, and it's because you can change a hypocrite's mind. If someone is talking to a bigoted position or taking a bigoted position to advance her self-interest, all you can do is, you know, change their mind and shift the political scales. You can convince the hypocrite that, you know, their self-interest would be better served by sucking up to you than the opponents, and they'll immediately become your new best friend. However, bigotry is consistent, and it's a fundamental part of their worldview. There is no convincing them. But the LGBT community, the proponents and the members of the support groups, there are many, you know, folks in there that didn't believe that way. But you can, you know, change minds. You see, the ranks of LGBT supporters are filled with bigots who change their minds when their friends or their colleagues or their children, their grandchildren came out to them as being gay. And so their tolerance is now just as strong as their old bigotry. So a hypocrite, though, will make nice with you one day and toss you out like the leftovers the minute you become inconvenient. You know, I just wonder what the log cabin Republicans think. I mean, I realize there's a need for a two-party system. There has to be, you know, a left and a right and meeting in the middle, but this extreme imbalance, this pendulum swung all the way to the left, has just about destroyed this country. Going on about Arkansas just a moment, he was, as I said earlier, a governor there for 10.5 years, and basically he staunchly and firmly and decidedly never, ever paid any attention to the LGBT community. Here's an example. There was one of these ceremonies he was attending, and a gay equality group or LGBT equality group stood up while he was speaking and unfurled a banner that said "Queer Equality Now." He went right on talking. He didn't miss a beat. He did not acknowledge it. And you see, that is the way he governed Arkansas. He refused to publicly even talk to people who were LGBT. He wouldn't broach the issue unless he was pressed on the subject, but behind the scenes, in his quiet inner way, he was a mean-spirited, gay-bashing bigot. And that's the way he handled the laws. In fact, in 1992, he wrote a press article saying that homosexuality is an aberrant, unnatural, and sinful lifestyle that posed a dangerous public health risk. And Huckabee has even said today he will not retreat from that statement, absolutely will not retreat at all. Said he's never supported civil unions. He's passed a law banning same-sex marriage, of course, and then put forth a law to prohibit sodomy to protect the traditional family structure. at one point he passed a law that there was a heterosexual man, and he wanted to become a foster parent, but because this heterosexual man lived with his gay son, his biological gay son, Huckabee said no way, and there was a lawsuit, and there was a decision to ban gay foster parenting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he's got a long history of it. It is deep, and it is to the core, and I don't think it is ever going to change. Lord, what can I tell you? Looking through some of my little notes here. Let's see here. Slightly confused, but that's all right. There we go. Huckabee says, it's not because I don't like them. he says it's because he likes the idea of family even more. And what he's talking about here is the militant family. He's talking about a stronger military and a stronger family. Everything's got to be strong and macho and stand up and upright. There's very little... I just don't see that as a family value. I see that as, you know, family militancy. To wrap it all up, over the next when he was in Sioux City, he plays a bass guitar, by the way. He played "Taking Care of Business" by Bachman Turner Overdrive. Remember that from the 70s? I used to play some Bachman Turner. Never really cared much for that particular track. Although some wonderful Bachman Turner Overdrive, but in any case, "Taking Care of Business," wouldn't you know, would be a top 40 and working overtime sort of a guy. Oh, Lord. Then you've got Uganda. The government should not yield to pressure and legalize homosexuality and lesbianism, says the bishop. The bishop Nicodemus Ockley. And he was delivering his Christmas sermon at St. Peter's Church of Uganda. He did that on Tuesday. And he said the acts violate both the biblical teachings on marriage, and it violates the African culture. And he criticized the gay rights leaders, saying they have no place in the kingdom of God, which, of course, I think I'm one of those. I'm not really a leader, but I'm sure he would sweep me in with that particular broad brush that I have no place in the kingdom of God. He says, these acts question the ordinances of God. You are intellectualizing sin. How do you imagine a woman sharing a bed with a woman or a man with a fellow man? Here they go. They can only think about sex. He says, according to the penal code, you know, there's so many differences between LGBT people, you know, the straight people. We're far more than what we do in bed, spiritually and culturally, in every way. That's all they can think about. In the same bed. Oh, my God. So he says, according to the penal code, I just love that word, the penal code, homosexuality is illegal, and it carries a maximum sentence of life. He says the sexual minorities, Uganda gay activists, addressed an unprecedented news conference to speak out against discrimination. And he said he wants laws to ban that, and he says it's terrible. He says, as a church, we need to resist practices that are not in line with Christian doctrine. Which leads me to a track I wanted to play this evening. You know, you hear all this stuff spoken in the name of the church, and you wonder, the track I'm about to play, you wonder how people can sing these songs. This is, in fact, a hymn. How people can sing these songs in the churches and still behave this way. It's just amazing to me. At least this is a hymn that's sung in the Methodist Church. Various churches, of course, sing different hymns. This particular one, you know, when way back the Methodists were called the Singing Methodists, and that's because John Wesley, you know, he was a songwriter, and he wrote a couple of hymns which are classics. I don't recall which one. He wrote "Christ the Lord is Risen Today," and of course, "Hark the Herald Angels Sing." But he actually wrote more than 6,000 hymns, but many of them were sung by the Methodist Church, not anymore. Many of them have faded into antiquity. But there is one not written by him. Not all the Methodist hymn books are written by Charles Wesley. I think I said John Wesley. I meant Charles Wesley. But certainly the hip, but there's a particular hymn, it's based on an old Scottish tune, you'll immediately recognize it, and the song is called Lord of the Dance, and we sing it sometimes in Methodist churches. It's absolutely my favorite song to sing. Now, we don't sound anything like this. What you're about to hear is the Mark Lowry on Broadway rendition, and it's a cappella of Lord of the Dance. And, you know, just compare what I read to you with the lyrics of this track. Bob, please run Lord of the Dance.
I danced in the morning when the world was begun, and I danced in the moon and the stars and the sun, and I came down from heaven and I danced on the earth. At Bethlehem I had my birth. Dance, man, wherever you may be, for I am the Lord of the dance, said he, and I'll lead you all wherever you may be, and I'll lead you all in the dance, said he.
I danced for the scribe and the Pharisee, but they wouldn't dance and they wouldn't follow me. I danced for the fishermen, for James and John. They came with me and the dance went on.
Dance then wherever you may be, for I am the Lord of the dance, said he, and I'll lead you all wherever you may be, and I'll lead you all in the dance, said he. I danced on the Sabbath and I cured the lame. The holy people said it was a shame. They whipped and they stripped and they hung me high, and they left me there on a cross to die. I danced on a Friday when the sky turned black. It's hard to dance with the world on your back. They buried my body and they thought I'd gone. But I am the dance and I still go
brings to mind another question. How could that song become the host of the George Bush Presidential Library? These things confound me. They confuse me. How can there be such a disparity between the song, the spirit, and what we're seeing from the religion industry? I'm just particularly horrified by it. And I don't understand it, and I will never be able to wrap my head around it. They are definitely embracing a spirit that I don't know, and it's a spirit that I don't care to know, and I don't think it's good for any of us. We have a 15-year-old 10th grader from White Plains. Well, actually, it's in New York, near White Plains. He's from Brewster. And it's a great story, really. He could not believe what he was seeing. He walked into the big hall, into the banquet hall of the Westchester County Center, and he got very, very quiet. And the reason he got quiet is because as far as the eye could see, there were hundreds of boys and girls who belonged to a gay straight club in the area's middle schools and high schools. His stepfather said it was a great moment for him because he had always felt so isolated. His name is Michael. He'd been looking forward to the day-long Pride Works conference so much that he jumped out of bed at 5:30 that morning. He was happy. He was nervous. He kept forgetting basic pieces of information like, Dad, what's our cell phone number? You know, things like that. The fact Michael has felt very different forever, for as long as he's known. Long before he even had a name for it, he knew that his family knew, even since he was 5 years old, that he was a gay child. He'd always hang out with the girls and not the boys, and never was allowed to play in the reindeer games. His mom said he had female tendencies, had very sensitive parts. His father is a flooring contractor, by the way. His mom is a teacher. So for various reasons, Michael went through this. He was treated for depression. He didn't know anyone like himself. He spent long hours in the computer. Several months ago, he told his parents he had met a nice boy from Australia online and wanted to bring him home for a visit, bring him to the U.S. for a visit, and he wanted his mommy and dad to pay for it. And he was very upset when they wouldn't, but, you know, his parents had to gently explain to him that, you know, they really couldn't afford to fly someone from Australia to visit with him. And, you know, it's difficult. Parents cannot make friends for their child. The child has to do that themselves. And his mother is saying, I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. And I honestly don't know how to help him. So the family put a good deal of hope in this particular conference. And as Michael said, I was feeling lonely and I wanted to meet people. So he went to the ninth year of the Pride Works gathering, which is put on by the Hudson Valley chapter of the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. That's Gleason. We've had them on the show. They came on with the Gay, Lesbian, Association, what is it, Alliance, Gay, Lesbian, Straight Alliance. We had a student from Denver who was on the show with the person from the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network. So in any case, it was put on by them, and it was also sponsored by numerous community groups, including a local Merrill Lynch. Boy, that's going to twist the fundy. The Westchester Putnam School Board Association, and several other organizations. So it began in 1999, and in the beginning there were no students. They were just there were 125 adults. There were mostly educators who worked with gay children and a few parents who desperately wanted to find other gay kids for their children to meet because it was not cool in high school and middle school to say that, you want to get beaten up. So this year there are about 200 adults along with 300 boys and girls, and some, like Michael, attended with their parents, and most of them arrived in school buses with their gay straight alliance clubs. And each of the 40 schools of delegations were announced, and there were cheers and woo-hoos, and there were 20 students from East Chester High and 21 from Tuckahoe High, and they went down the list. And to say all who was there. One of the fellows, Michael, he's 17, he was the president of the Lakeland High Club, he's straight. He persuaded his dad, Norman, the police chief, to run a seminar that discussed legal protections for gays and police prejudice there. So much of the day was filled with seminars on coming out, when do you come out, where do you come out, seminars on the Gay Straight Alliance in middle school, there were seminars on hip-hop and homophobia. We've talked about some of the lyrics of this show. We've talked about we have too, for that matter, what is transgendered, healthy relationships, et cetera, et cetera. Things that straight kids take for granted, you know, healthy relationships and all that sort of thing. You know, support of the community, the family, you know, peers. But these kids don't get that. I remember what that was like. I know very well what it was like. One of the kids said, when I first walked in, I felt like crying. There were so many people to meet. I'm seeing so many people who are like me for the very first time. So, you see, Brian came out in the seventh grade, and he'd be walking down the halls, and the kids would yell fag and So in the eighth grade, he said to a group of boys in the gym, well, actually the boys said it to him. They made him wait outside the locker room and leave the locker room, you know, while they were inside changing, and then he would have to come in after they had left to change into his uniform. And so anyway, he didn't want to make a big deal of it, Brian didn't, so he just waited. And so the gym teacher asked him why he wasn't getting dressed with the others, why was he waiting outside, and he told his gym teacher straight up, he said, it's because I'm gay, and they don't feel like it's appropriate. The gym teacher responded, I can't disagree with them. Got so bad for Brian that the family discussed moving to another school district. We didn't want Brian to be the only kid in the whole high school, and of course there had to be others, but they were also deeply in the closet. So at the end of the eighth grade, they took him for a day-long visit to the John Jay High in another suburb. It was miles away, but this particular school had a lesbian, gay, straight alliance going, and Brian loves it there, so they've moved there, and now he's a freshman, and he's much happier, and his life is much easier, and that's what kids are going through these days. By the way, there was something I wanted to point out the other evening. It was last evening when we did the story regarding the fellow Stable. Remember Stable? He was the fellow who was healed of his homosexuality in front of JR's of all places, which is a big old gay club there in Dallas, on the sidewalk, and apparently wasn't really healed. They swept him off to one of the ex-gay facilities. I forget the name of it, True Love or some rigmarole, and then they kicked him out. But that fellow, you remember the fellow who shot up the over in Denver, part of the Dobson's organization there. There was a church. I think so. Two people were killed in a church, and two people were killed in one of the youth fellowship thing. But you know, that kid went through the same exposure to this sort of evangelical hype that our friend Stamos did last evening. You know, the constant, you know, Stamos was telling us, you know, constantly that you're going to go to hell, and all this pressure, you have to sleep with your pajamas all buttoned up to your neck, and you can't shake hands, and all this, you know, rigmarole, and they teach you to play football, and all these external things which are absolutely completely irrelevant to anything about sexual orientation. So any case, that just reminded me of that. But Brian is saying it's wonderful there are so many people here. He said a few students had brightly dyed hair and exotic piercing, and some dressed in goth, but most people just wore the standard teenage uniform, sweatshirts, jeans, you know. He's not an overly flamboyant kid, so... Michael didn't do anything much except, he didn't talk much. He was just overwhelmed. He went to four seminars that day, and he said, I'm so new to it, I'm still getting used to it. And his mom said, every time I looked at him, I could see this big, cheesy grin. And Robert is another kid. He makes a comment, I'm tired of people assuming I'm straight. There was a lapel button that was out for a while back that you could wear it. It read, how dare you presume I'm heterosexual? I thought it was kind of funny. Of course, you can't get away with wearing that sort of thing down here. And then Uruguay, for crying out loud. Uruguay. Jesus. And compare this. Now we've got Uruguay, and it's the first Latin American country to recognize civil unions. The president signed it into law. He signed it into law Thursday, which today, this news is just 6 hours old, granting legal rights to cohabitating couples of any gender. And so the new law guarantees homosexuals or heterosexuals or couples that have lived together continuously benefits and are joined by married couples, such as joint property ownership, hereditary rights, the whole business. The text and the law recognizes two people of any sex or any identity or any orientation or any sexual option who maintain an emotional relationship, sexual in nature, that's exclusive, stable, and permanent. Okay, well, I think there are probably a lot of them. So the bill sparked intense debates in Congress before it was approved. But so In Latin America, there are civil unions between homosexuals that are recognized in certain local jurisdictions, like some cities in Mexico, some cities in Brazil, some cities in Argentina, Buenos Aires. But Uruguay, for crying out loud, is the first country to recognize. So now they're moving closer. We've got Canada, we've got Massachusetts, we've got Uruguay, we have Spain. The list goes on and on and on. But no. We are still in this country trying to battle against some sort of a backwoods Baptist throwback who's all about a strong military and a strong family because we're going to fight. Jesus. I don't know where all this hate comes from, but it damn sure comes from somewhere. Should probably play my request tonight. I got a request that I had to laugh. I was very amused when I got this request in an email. It's for a rare Abitrack. And the only reason I have this Abitrack is because quite some time ago, one of our moderators in the chat room actually sent me, we're talking about ABBA one day, and she actually sent me this rare Abitrack. Okay. And so I was floored when in an email someone requested it because I figured that she and I were the only two people in the entire universe that knew about it. Now, it's not only a request, it is a dedication. This is from Paul to Robert. Now, Robert, I don't know what Paul is trying to tell you here, but maybe you can read between the lines here, but Robert, it doesn't sound good. So anyway, yes, we do have it, and yes, this track was within the Head On Radio Network family, and so we're glad to play it for you, and I was glad to have it, and it's unusual to have something this odd. But it's from Paul to Robert, and put on your white sombrero.
Find a sweet sense, Eureka!
Well, Robert, I have to tell you, unless there is some sort of a, this is some sort of a private joke or a little private story between you and Paul, Robert, I think things are looking pretty grim for you, buddy. So, just a little shout out from Strictly Confidential, and that was from Paul. We accept no responsibility for whatever the hell that means. So, anyway, Merry Christmas to you both and a Happy New Year. Wasn't such a Merry Christmas in London for a young Iranian man. He started in London, but it was a court in Netherlands that has pretty much ruined everything. A court in Netherlands has ruled that the gay Iranian teenager has to be returned to the United Kingdom, where he faces deportation back to Iran. Now, you see, he left England last spring when the Home Office Tribunal dismissed his appeal. His appeal was, of course, to not be deported back to the country where he would likely be beheaded or receive lashes or worse. He was refused the right to appeal of asylum in the Netherlands. You see, he moved to the Netherlands to file it again there because of something called the Dublin Treaty. Now, the Dublin Treaty is just a European Union law that prevents asylum applicants from applying for asylum in multiple member states. So they have you on a technicality there. So he's, of course, very disappointed. His lawyer is making a final appeal to the Netherlands High Court. You see, what the problem is he's 19. He's worried that this early decision from the court is going to be handed down, you know, during the New Year period, you know, when everybody's on vacation and what have you, and that his deportation to the UK would be made over the holiday period, and he would have no chance to argue against this. He's frightened, and he's sure he's going to be executed if he returns to Iran. You see, he left Iran in 2004 to continue his education in England. He had a student visa, and it was issued by the UK. He had a boyfriend. His boyfriend he left behind in Iran. So the boyfriend that was left behind was eventually outed as being gay, and he was rounded up by the authorities, and he was tortured. And he gave up the name of his partner who was in the United Kingdom. And so now that they have his name, Iran wants him back to, they want him back to execute him. The boyfriend was executed too. So, and this I can't begin to understand how people can be so obtuse. The reason that his asylum appeal failed, okay, was because the tribunal judge found that the dates on the Iranian paperwork didn't match up with what the teenager had said. Okay, but the tribunal refuses to accept the fact that the Iranian calendar is entirely different than the Western calendar, the Gregorian calendar. So, I mean, you can look it up on Wikipedia, people. I mean, I just cannot believe how obtuse. So that was the reason his appeal was denied, because the dates didn't match and the court could not accept the fact that the Iranian calendar is different than the calendar in the United Kingdom. So Merry Christmas to that young fellow. A student in Virginia did get a good Christmas. She's a high school student, and she a high school official made the mistake of telling her to cover up her lesbian-themed T-shirt or face suspension. And the ACLU is demanding an apology to the team. Now, this, you may be wondering, what is a lesbian? A lesbian T-shirt? Well, it was just the two female symbols, you know, the male and the female symbols, we all know those, interlocked. Those two female symbols interlocked. And she wore it while she was as a red T-shirt, and she wore it in a hotel management class, and she's a senior at the nearby high school. And the person that was giving the seminar said they had to she had to take that off or she was going to face suspension. And so what she did was she zipped her jacket up and she wore it again about a week later, and they said they were going to send her to the principal's office and expel her. Anyway, the ACLU has gotten involved, and they have ordered the administrators to remove any mention of the incident from her records and agree not to similarly to censor other students in a similar way. you know, she was just in shock. She just liked the T-shirt. I don't even know if she's a lesbian or not, but she just liked the T-shirt. It's not clear here what her orientation is. So, you know, that really, you know, the school has a rule there that clothing can't be sexually provocative. There's several criteria here, but certainly two female symbols drawn with the circles connect could not be in any way construed as sexual in nature. It's just statement of support, I suppose. Well, let's see, where do we stand? Yes. NBC News 5. Apparently, there may be a serial killer active in Chicago who's targeting black gay men. And the leaders of the Chicago Black Lesbian and Gay Organizations are announcing a community alert. There have been two recent homicides, which are almost identical, and they are both black gay men. The groups are, you know, are alerting the gay and lesbian community and asking for the police to investigate the deaths of the hate crime. The first one was the death of Larry Bland, and this was on November 17th. And the second one was Donald Young, only a few weeks later. Now Bland lived in a certain block on Wood Street, and he was shot in the head in his home. And he was a 24-year-old black male. His brother said he thinks his brother's death was clearly a hate crime because he was black and he was gay. He was the only guy in the entire community of Englewood that was out. And he'd tell you to your face, you know, I'm gay. What's your problem or what's your point when he was confronted with it? Now, the other fellow, Young, he was found unresponsive in his home at about 7:30 in the morning with the Christmas presents. So this is on Christmas Day. The Christmas presents were missing, and there was jewelry missing from the home. Now, Young was a deacon and a choir director at Trinity United Church of Christ, and he was also a young man. He was he had conducted the choir there for two decades, and it's a very high-profile black church, and the reverend there said that he lived and breathed the music. He was also shot inside of his home, and Young also taught the fourth grade at an elementary school. And so no arrests have been made in that so far, so that's an interesting twist to go after. This is both a hate crime and a race crime rolled into one, if the news reports are true there. Our friends, Bill Browning over at the Blerico Project, did an interesting summary of the year. Thank you, guys. I'm going to mention some of that. They rate it from 1 to 10, the biggest news items regarding the LGBT community in the year 2007. They're wondering if it was the year of the queer. The community is getting more and more visible, and there's plenty to talk about. But they're wondering over at Blerico, our friend Bill Browning, if anything got accomplished. And quite frankly, not a lot did. There was the number one, the huge INDA split. It's the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, of which Barney Frank made headlines across the world when he dropped the transgendered community, just making it the LGBT community, forgetting about the transgendered, which led to all the gay organizations, around 300 of them, all up in arms over it. And then Barney Frank wrote an explanation and posted it at the Blerico Project, and then Lambda's president, Kevin Cathcart, also wrote an article and put it on Blerico, and then Barney Frank responded back, and there was response back. So anyway, the debate raged back and forth, and Congress was confused. We're so confused. They didn't know whether to vote in favor of the bill, which was, of course, going to be vetoed by the president anyway. So if it was going to be vetoed by the president, why not include everybody? It wasn't like it was going to pass anywhere as long as he's in office. So then Tammy Baldwin offered the amendment to include the gender identity to put it back in, but she ended up withdrawing it. And so anyway, the non-inclusive version passed the House and it died in the Senate, and it never made it to Bush so that he could veto it. So that was number one. Number two was the hate crimes that didn't get anywhere. It was introduced in the, I mean, it's just been a total bust. The Senate was introduced, the House in March introduced sexual orientation and gender identity inclusive hate crimes legislation. And, of course, the religious right went nuts, saying that it would interfere with their freedom of hate speech. And it was, by the way, they named that the Matthew Shepard Act. And the legislation was attached to a bill that Bush was expected to approve because it was more money for him to go kill people in Iraq. And then he said he would veto it. And then the people were all fighting with each other about whether they should have included it with the legislation for the additional funds for the war. And of course, it created a split between the anti-war Democrats and the anti-gay Republicans. Anyway, that fell apart. Then you've got the Episcopals. The Worldwide Anglican Communion is continuing to fight. They haven't fallen apart yet, but they're continuing to fight. You've got the American Episcopalians refusing to back down, and the conservative leaders are all up in arms. Well, they got a bishop down there in Nigeria who's the current star of the Episcopalian anti-gay movement, and he's arguing it's going to continue to divide the church. And some churches in the United States are splitting off, but only a few. So anyway, the Episcopals are still melting down. Then we had one of the stories that nobody could have possibly missed. Larry Craig got outed in the most embarrassing way. Of course, he's a huge anti-gay fellow with he backs all the laws, does everything the religious right wants him to do. And he was caught in a toilet offering, what was it? Is he the $20 guy or is he the expensive guy? It's hard to remember. They all blur together after a while. We had Larry Craig. And then there was the HRC debate on the Logo channel. Do you remember that? The LGBT folks, they televised the event the candidates talking about LGBT issues like the Defense of Marriage Act. And that's still, who knows what that was about. That still didn't get anything accomplished, and it was all pretty much political posturing. Then there was Mary Cheney's baby. Mary Cheney, of course, was Vice President Dick Cheney's lesbian daughter, and she had a son with her partner, Heather Poe. And, of course, Mary helped Bush Cheney get elected on a platform of anti-gay and warmongering. And then when her father and the boss opposed gay families at all costs on the campaign trail, Blairco puts it, the little princess defended her family with a statement of, "My child is not a political statement." Oh, the depth. Oh, the depth. So, and then, of course, the official White House photos showed only the smiling grandparents, Darth and his wife, but there was no sign of the lesbians. And just quickly, there was New Jersey civil unions. There was Jerry Falwell's death. There was Don't Ask, Don't Tell that didn't get fixed. So, in conclusion, INDA, still not U.S. law. Hate crime, still not U.S. law. Episcopal, still split in principle, but not split in reality. Larry Craig still hasn't left office. Mary Cheney, her child is not a political statement. Jerry Falwell, I think, resolved. Anyway, thanks, guys, from the Blairco Project. That was a great summary, and I think you did hit all the right spots. And I'll need to get in touch with the Blairco Project soon. We're talking about a little thing, which we'll tell you folks about later. It is the top of the hour, and Bob has our guest on the line, I'm pleased to say. And our guest is Isaiah Brokenleg. Now, Isaiah is a gay Lakota male. There's a word for it, but I still dare not risk pronouncing it. He will do it for us. He was raised in a traditional Lakota culture where he learned that queer people should be honored. And then this was on the reservation, and then he moved to Seattle at age 14 and encountered an entirely different world. He is, I believe this is correct. He'll correct us if we're wrong in the dates here, but I believe he's about 28 years old. And he is an enrolled member of the Rosebud Sioux tribe in South Dakota. And it's traditionally in Lakota culture that they're honored and respected as being healers and spiritual, physical, emotional community. In the traditional, I understand there are some differences in the more contemporary cultures. In any case, he is going to join us now and talk to us about what that's like and how they treat two-spirited people versus the way we treat them in the Christian world. And we'll talk about the split from the Lakota Indian tribe from the United States. He has some insights about that that will surprise you. And any number of things. I am so pleased to welcome to the show, Isaiah, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Hello.
Good evening to you. Can you hear me okay, Isaiah?
Yep, I sure can.
Wonderful, wonderful. I'm so glad that you're able to join us this evening. As I spoke with you just briefly today and to kind of fill you in on what we were trying to do, you know, when this whole thing about the Lakota tribe came up, it was my immediate thought that we should try to find out more about how LGBT folks are treated, and we came across you in that search, and I'm delighted you have joined us. At first, how do you pronounce that word?
Well, let me clear up a few things first. I'm not funny.
Okay, no.
I just had my 30th birthday. And,
okay, this is a couple of years. Okay.
And I don't actually identify as gay. I just identify as not straight.
Okie doke, that's good too. And that's interesting you would say that, because more than one article has said that that particular word means non-straight. And it's an interesting,
right. Interesting,
yeah.
So the word is wink day, and it's actually we eat ink day, which I guess loosely translated means sort of talks like a woman, maybe. Most people who don't speak Lakota will tell you that it means to kill women, because they kill and we meaning woman. But it's actually a sort of a conjunction or two bigger words made into it, one smaller word.
I see.
And well, Lakota boys talk one way and girls talk another way. And so it just means the one who talks like a woman, loosely translated.
Well, traditionally, I'm wondering, how did Christianity the colonization and the whole bit, how did that affect the lives of LGBT folks in the Lakota community?
Well, let me say that I can speak from my experience, and there's like many different Lakota tribes, and I'm Sichahu, which is just one particular tribe. And of course, each person is going to have their own experience, but that word wink day is not so much a sexual thing as it is a spiritual or social role. And so you have it's considered a blessing, or you know, it's good. It was a good thing. It wasn't a bad thing to be wink day. But at the same time, along with those privileges, you have great responsibilities. And I think Christianity did a whole lot of things, but I think colonization, more importantly, and did a lot worse things. And Christianity is, I would say, mistaken Christianity, because there were a lot of missionaries and people who really had their best intentions. And you were talking about Episcopalians earlier, and they actually were, I would say, one of the better people. And when there was a time when they split all the church, every tribe had a different church assigned to it. So these tribes here were Presbyterian, and these ones here were Episcopalian, and these ones here were Catholic. And a lot of the churches, after accepting that responsibility, later had to pull out because they didn't know what they were doing. Eric couldn't.
My stars, assigned churches. Imagine that. I had no idea.
And that was part of Grant's Peace Treaty, I think is what it was called. I'm kind of blanking on the name right now. But anyway, I think what you find with the mistaken Christianity is that there's a lot of patriarchy, sexism that comes along with that. And in Lakota culture, women's roles were sacred and they were very important, and women were given higher status than men in many cases. Nearly all. It was a matrilineal society. So they were honored and respected. And as far as the wink day, they were seen as having being able to walk between the masculine and the natural and the supernatural. And so having that unique insight, they were the healers like physical healer, emotional healer, spiritual healer, and I guess growing up I was taught that you have to behave like that. You know, you're a holy person, so you have to behave like a holy person, and if you didn't behave like that, you wouldn't be given the same status in society. And I think that's where I really struggle with the GLBT community as a whole, because our cultural values, generosity, community-orientedness, kinship, wisdom, a lot of things that I don't see in the overarching stereotypical gay society. I see too much focus on themselves and too much materialism and superficiality, and those are all things that would be considered very anti what the role of a Wink Day was a long time ago.
Well, I have to agree with you along those lines. It still makes my head spin when I go to some of the LGBT news sites, and I understand they have to support themselves, but, you know, the advertising is all about, skin and vacations and all. It's all about me, 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 and self. And this is fascinating to me that you point out that the Lakota looked upon the LGBT people as it being a spiritual condition, because in the world that I grew up in, it's always treated as a sexual thing. It's all about sex, what they do in bed, and the condemnation. It's against nature, blah 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 blah. But you're saying it was a spiritual thing. Can you tell us more about that? It's very interesting to me.
Well, like I said, it was believed that you walk between the worlds of the natural and supernatural, masculine and feminine, and so you have unique insight, and you have a responsibility to your community to make sure that they're taken care of and to look after them, and you know, you could have kids, I suppose, but you generally didn't, and so you took care of everyone's kids. And in fact, you sometimes you name children. There's some people got what's called a Wink Day name, which is usually, ironically, something kind of funny or humorous. Usually the name translated would be quite humorous. And that's separate. It's usually known only to the Wink Day and you and maybe one of your parents. And then you would invoke that name at a time of great need and just believe that you would get sort of extra strength or spiritual help or something along those lines at that time. And I think a lot of very important people were Wink Day people, spiritual leaders throughout the time, you know, different and many different tribes, I guess. And one of the things I think it's important to, I guess, remember is that there are other spiritual roles for people who aren't Wink Day, but I think what we forget sometimes is that we're all sexual beings, and so it really doesn't matter, I guess, who we have sex with necessarily, at least from my perspective. It's more about...
Well, that certainly makes a lot of sense to me. There's a very different... And it's painfully obvious to anyone who's in the LGBT community or anywhere along that spectrum that it's not just the sleeping with a partner that is unexpected to heterosexuals is the least of it. We are so different in so many ways. It's difficult to quantify, and it's remarkable to me to hear that the Lakota respected that.
They did. I don't know what else to say about it. They do. They did. I think you'll see that nowadays. I had some challenges growing up, and a lot of what you'll see is the more assimilated or contemporary people have more of a struggle with it, I think, and a lot of them don't know about the tradition, but if you know anybody who's traditional, they definitely are much more open and accepting and follow that older role, but then, again, you have that responsibility to also live your life in that way, too.
Isaiah, I understand that you're deeply involved in service work, and this is of interest to us also. We had a group on the show a couple of months ago. The archives are on the website, a group called Fierce, you may be aware of them there in New York. They are an organization that supports transgendered, lesbians, gays, bisexual, two-spirited, queer questioning, etc., and youth of color. And one of the things that they have to address and that they work on and try to help people with is the sex industry. You know, when kids have no frame of reference or no place they can call home, that's many times what they have to do to survive. And I understand that you're involved in the service community to try to help that. Do you think that that's a regard, did that come about because of the slap in the face? I would interpret it as a slap in the face anyway. When you left the reservation and went to Seattle when you were 14, I think you're treated very differently. Is it that fundamental understanding that caused you to enter service?
That just kind of happened. I experienced homelessness myself and also experienced the sex industry myself. And I think that it was a really strange, I guess, how it happened. It was all very surreptitious, I guess. It just kind of happened. But I ended up, you know, working for different agencies, and originally I was like an intern with something, and then they moved me up to being a youth worker and different things like that. And I think what I could see is some of the injustices that occur, and that helped me build rapport with the youth that I worked with. And I think I also had some personal experience with it, and that also helped me as well. But I think it's really hard if you find yourself homeless or home is unsafe and you're very young. What do you have? Like, you can't get a job. You have this goal, you know, you need to be 16 to work, and what are you going to do? What are you going to turn to? And as unfortunate as it is, again, this is an example where the gay community doesn't always do the things that they need to, is that if you go outside any gay bar just about, you'll find some predatory men who are willing to pay young boys for sex. And that, I think, is one of the sad pieces of our community that we need to address and look at, and how I think it's everyone's responsibility to fix that problem. And I think, again, if the old Wink Day were looking down and seeing what we do and how we live our lives, they would just be appalled that, you know, that should never happen. And in our community, the Lakota community, there's no such thing as an orphan, because they're usually always adopted by your next of kin. That's kind of how it's supposed to happen. And I think we as a society aren't being good relatives to everyone.
Well, you've explained that beautifully in an article that I've read about you. And there's a phrase that I dare not utter because I won't be able to pronounce it correctly, but it's a phrase that means all my relatives. Can you tell us what that means?
Well, yeah, the phrase is mitakuyo yasin, or some people say mitakuyo wasin. And that's usually uttered at the end of a prayer or other times. And it can mean different things. But it can mean all my relatives. It can mean God bless all my relatives. It can mean we're all related. And when we say relative, what we mean is that, you know, this is like people and plants and animals and nature itself, like rocks and mountains and things like that. And we're all related. And I think we have a responsibility to remember that and to be a good relative to everyone and everything. And I think when you look at, I'm going to link it back to something else. When you look at, like, the overarching message of Christianity or the Bible, that's the overarching message. But that's the piece that everybody forgets.
Yeah, absolutely, my friend. Absolutely.
We need to remember that.
It is. Yes, it in fact, as you were saying that, the very same thoughts occurred to me, in as much as this is what Christianity purports to be. However, it has fallen far short of that. The concept of relatives being all human beings, and including our environment, and even it mentions animals, plants, inanimate objects, that it's all part of a collective whole. And it brings to mind, how are these values are these values still surviving on the reservation? Is this about to disappear? What is the status of the culture at this point?
Well, I think there are some very valiant people who understand that the, you know, as our elders are aging and different things, that, you know, that we stand a good chance of losing our culture if we don't step up to the plate. And I think there's some people who are doing such a thing. And I would argue that like kind of Russell Means or Dennis Means, whoever went down there, I think it's Dennis Banks and Russell Means, but who went down there and did the whole thing. Part of that is them fighting to keep their culture. And I think he had the best intentions. I think that we all need to take some responsibility for that, including the people who are here. People love to talk about how, you know, English is supposed to be the national language. Well, it's not really. Well, it isn't. But people like it is. We have a lot of problems with language protection and keeping it. People do fight to keep the culture alive, and I definitely think it's definitely not lost. There's some very traditional people who live their life in a very good way, and I think many of us strive to live our life in a good way. And you see some people balancing. So how do you balance the, you know, contemporary pieces with the traditional pieces? And how do, you know, I have a master's of public health, so I'm trained to do certain public health things, and how do I balance that with my traditional concept of what the medical system looks like and how that works?
Yes. Well, you mentioned language, but before we move into the medical, you mentioned language, and this is important, too, because apparently there is a word, and I'm pronouncing it, I'm guessing at it, Berdash, that apparently is a huge blanket term that really wasn't your word. In other words, it's way too broad, and people are painting. Can you tell us about that word, Berdash, and what's up with that? I didn't fully this is all so new to me. Isaiah, you just have to kind of treat me like a kindergartner. I don't understand. Tell me about Berdash.
Well, I don't understand that word either. As much as I do understand it, I think it's like an anthropological term or something that's used to define a person who is not straight or who might be transgender. I think it's kind of like a blanket word. That's how I understand it, but I don't use that word. It's not my word, so I don't know much about it. I think each culture will have its own word, and any culture has its own understanding of what that person is or how it works or what their responsibility is or if they're any different or, you know, all of those things. And I know when I look around, you know, in my communities that I work in or in my communities that I live in and the American Indian community, that's something I really appreciate. I've never, even in the more, you know, really sort of more contemporary ones, I've never been asked to leave my, what do you want to call it, my gay or wink day or whatever hat at the door. But I think a lot of times when I enter the stereotypical gay community, I've been asked to leave my Indian hat at the door, and they don't want to hear about their racist comments. They don't want to hear about how they're oppressing people or their sexist comments. They want you just to be gay and fit in this way and look like this and do like that, and that's generally, I think, what they want. And that really went way off topic of your question. But I think each person has a different word, and I think two-spirit is another word that you often hear people use, with the idea being that we have two spirits, maybe the masculine and the feminine, or maybe two spirits, just natural and supernatural. That word, I don't exactly know the origin. Someone told me once that it was developed in an urban area in California to kind of be encompassing of American Indian philosophy of gay people, but oftentimes that word doesn't translate correctly in different languages. Like sometimes it means possessed, like you have your own spirit plus the spirit of someone else, which would mean you're possessed, or in other languages. It doesn't always work. So some people really like it and some people really don't like it. And one mistake that I think a lot of people make is that all Indians are the same. But, you know, my tribe is quite different from a lot of other tribes, and our values might be quite different, or our social structure might be quite different, and so that one word won't work for everybody.
I see. And so this is probably part of why the word Berdash isn't a good word. It's a social science word, if I dare say that paints with a broad brush but does not acknowledge tribal differences. Does that get it?
I think so. I would say something like that. You know, and maybe social science has rejected it. I don't know, but that's the only place I've ever read about it. Writing, and I think they're trying to come up with that concept of, I think a lot of different cultures or tribes have, I would probably argue a lot of indigenous tribes all across the world have that concept of, they have a place for GLBT people. And I think we have one of the few societies, we mean the Western world, that doesn't have a place for GLBT people except in a negative one.
I see. So as the younger people spread out into the general culture, the New Yorks, the Atlantas, the Los Angeles, they perhaps don't know the internal language of their people, and so the term Two-Spirit, is that kind of the general term these days, broad brush?
Broad brush, I think a lot. Some American Indians, it's kind of like, do we call ourselves gay, or do we call ourselves queer, or do we call ourselves lesbian? It's kind of like that. I think queer would be, Two-Spirit would be the queer of the, of the. Some people for a lot of different reasons might not like that word, Two-Spirit, because it doesn't meet their needs or their culture. And a lot of African Americans don't like the word queer, for example. And I think some American Indians don't like the word Two-Spirit. They haven't even heard of that concept. You know, I came from a reservation in South Dakota. I had never heard. I think I heard the word gay and I heard the word dyke. I don't think I ever heard the word lesbian until I moved to Seattle, and I had no idea what those things were. It was all very foreign, but I knew what a Winkler was, and I knew what their role was, and I knew what their responsibilities were in society. But
well, this is magical to me. This is so, it resonates so strongly with me because the words you just said, you knew what your responsibilities were, you knew what your role was in society, and that's something that the other of us, the ones who grew up in, you know, outside and in the traditional society that we have all around us, the mob, we don't know. We're brought up, we don't know our roles, and we don't know what we're supposed to do. In many ways, we're brought up, we have to invent them for ourselves. Do you think that that might be why some of the LGBT people seem to be so damn self-righteous, but self-loving, self-absorbed?
I think that's, I have a theory about it, and I'm sure somebody will tear it apart in some editorial that they'll make later, but I don't see it so much in the lesbian community. I see a lot more in the gay community, which kind of seems to like be the Pac-Man of all the other lesbians and transgender and everything. They just kind of expect everybody to assimilate to them. Maybe a lot like white people do expect everyone else to assimilate to them. But I think what I see is that because society does not accept gays and lesbians, bisexuals, transgendered, as we grow up, our whole process of dating people and experimenting and getting comfortable with our sexuality and figuring out who we are and knowing that we're okay gets stopped somewhere, you know, whenever we realize, oh, being gay is bad or being gay equals bad or whatever. It gets stopped. And finally, when we finally decide to come out, then we have to relive that whole adolescence all over again. And so these 20 and 30-year-olds that you see being very me-centered are going through their adolescence.
that's brilliant thinking.
Or whatever it is. And so that's why you see all of that me-centered stuff. And they don't realize it until later when they're older, that it's important and we need to get a sense of community or we need to help others. And obviously there are young people who do believe this, otherwise, you know, you wouldn't see so much activism, and there are older people who believe this and they do it. But I think then at the same time, because we still have the adolescence thing going on, the younger community rejects the older ones and like, oh, you're too old. You know, if you're over, I don't know what the word is now, like 30 is what, 50 in gay years or something like that. I can't remember what people say, but you know, we do a good job of not being intergenerational because you see the you know, older generation preying upon the very young generation, vulnerable generation, and then you see the younger generation rejecting the older generation. And I think that's a huge sense of community that we're missing. And that's one thing.
Well, I completely agree in every way with you. I can't begin to tell you how deeply and fundamentally I agree with what you're saying. And we've talked about some of these issues in the sense of aging on this program. The baby boomers, the generations are aging, and it won't be long before the many of us in the LGBT community are going to be needing extended care and long-term care. And with this huge cutoff between young and old, just seems like a terrible road. You know, there will be no family visiting, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yep. And I think that's one of those pieces that we as a community, we LGBT people as a community really need to get a hold of and figure out. And I think we as a society need to do that too in general, because we're really bad about that. One thing I can tell you, in Lakota culture, we definitely value our elders, at least traditionally, and I argue that there's a lot of people who still value their elders, which doesn't necessarily mean you have to agree with them. But you'll see a lot more intergenerational activities going on, I think, in a reservation community than you would maybe in a larger urban area or a larger non-Indian community. And that's, I think, really important, because there's a role for everybody. And then you have that connection.
From your lips to God's ears, if only the world could change that way out here, because it's just a nasty, nasty place. Isaiah, about your medical training, I understand that you are still helping the Lakota and perhaps other tribes using your medical skills. What is it that you do?
Well, I'm not really helping the Lakota. I actually got the first job when I got out of school. I applied for one job in Epic City, South Dakota, which would have been working with the Lakota Dakotas, but I didn't actually get that job. So, but I got hired at the Lac des Flambeaux Indian Reservation, which is in Wisconsin, and I work serving the Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan tribes that are in all of those areas. And so that's some Dakota, some Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, Ho-Chunk, Menominee, Potawatomi. I'm going to forget a few. There's a wide range of tribes that are represented there. Basically, I do a lot of surveillance work, looking at the mortality rate of heart disease, diabetes, all of those kind of things, and helping tribes to develop plans, or helping tribes, if they need assistance somehow, with doing surveys or coming up with data, because there's not enough American Indian epidemiology data that exists. Like, we don't know, you know, how many American Indians smoke, for example. People try and figure it out, but usually we're the last thing people think of. It's usually black, white, and other, and that's kind of where we go. It's black, white, Latino.
The other. Yeah, that's got to be a rude other when you think about it.
Right, and so you never know. And I think also the community, there's a lot of missing data, too, because of identification purposes and what are we calling them. Like, are LGBT people only self-identified ones? Are we trying to figure out what, you know, the closet people health looks like? Are we trying to figure out just men who have sex with men? And, you know, like, there's all of these different things, and it really presents a challenge, I think, in a lot of ways. But I think it's important that we get that data, because without it, we don't really know what's going on or how it's working.
Well, Isaiah, your entire life is about service. I found that out in reading about you. And apparently you're also very active in the Episcopal Church. Apparently you did a whole homily in the Lakota language. I'm not sure. Tell us about that. It was a conference or something?
Yeah, that was at the General Convention, which took place in Columbus, Ohio. And they asked me to do one of the readings in Lakota. And so I did. That was a bit of a challenge, because there's no Bible in Lakota. There's a Bible in Dakota, which was out of print since 1911 or 14 or something. So I had to find that Bible and then copy it, because they're not going to let you just walk away with it. And then you have to translate from Dakota to Lakota. And there's a quick and dirty way to do it, and then there's a more appropriate way to do it. And I had my uncle do the more appropriate version. And that would require a few words that actually get changed, instead of just changing some of the dialectical differences. But that was quite an experience. I'm very active in the Episcopal Church. I'm very aware of a lot of the stuff going on. I actually got to see Dean Robinson, who is, everybody thinks of as a gay bishop. I got to see him get consecrated. And he got consecrated a few years ago. I guess I don't know. I I think, I guess if you want to talk about missionizing and stuff like that, what I think you see, oh, there's an old school thought or belief where American Indians had to reject all that was Lakota in order to be Christian, because their ceremonies were like the devil or whatever, and that's more of the old school of thought. And I think the new school of thought says that that we need to like Jews have their Old Testament and we read it in the Bible. You know, that's their Bible, that's their history. They had the fortune of writing it down. Every single culture has its own Old Testament, and for us, those are our ceremonies and our traditions, and they're not bad. They're good and they're sacred and they're holy, and Christianity and Lakota culture can go together because the overarching message of the Bible, like I said, is being a good relative. And if you read, sorry, I'm going to quote the Bible for just a second. If you read in Corinthians, I'm not going to quote it, I guess, but the whole part about Corinthians is about how to missionize to other cultures and communities. And what the Bible tells, if you read it and you truly listen to it, what it says is you need to accept the culture you're going into. Like, that's not, well, are we supposed to have everybody be circumcised? Well, Paul said, no, you do what their culture does. Well, can we eat whatever, you know, whatever they're eating? And Paul says, yes, they're going to have their food, and you let them eat it. And basically, it's about delivering a message of reconciliation and redemption. And not, these are what you have to do and how you have to change your life. Bringing it back to the gay thing, Peter Akinola, the one in Nigeria, when we went to Africa, the Episcopal Church came to Africa and were missionizing and converting people, we accepted the fact that they had multiple wives. That was part of their culture, and we did not ask them to change, ever.
Yeah.
In fact,
yeah.
Some bishops in Africa still have multiple wives. So when they come to the United States with American Indians, where GLBT were accepted by at least for sure my tribe and many others, they should not be asking us to change our culture and asking us to say that gay people are bad when, for all my history and all I know, that we are holy and sacred people just like everyone else.
Wow, what a perspective, Isaiah. You're blowing me away. I've got to tell you, the chat room has come to a complete stop. We're all hanging on every word. This is incredible stuff. What an experience you've had. What an incredible experience. Tell us, I have to bring this up. You were one of the first responders when the bridge collapsed. You were there before the medical teams, I understand. You were there before the 911 people. In fact, you were one of the people who called 911. You witnessed this outside of a window or in an office. Can you tell us that story? I know you're not the sort of soul that likes to talk, you know, to make themselves sound like a hero, but you've got to tell us the story, please.
Okay, well, I was working late that day. I usually work late every day, because I usually come late every day. But that was when I was in college, or in grad school, and I worked in the West Bank office building, which the bridge goes right by it, or the 35W does. And I was there, and my boss came into my cubicle and was like, hey, let's go get something to eat. And all of a sudden I heard this god-awful noise. And I was like, is that what an accident sounds like? You know, because sometimes you can hear semis whizzing by and stuff. And she looked out the window and she turned on to the bridge collapse. And I stood up and you could see smoke everywhere. And it was just crazy. And I called 911. And I'm sure a lot of other people did because I got busy signal for a little while. And then she's like, we got to go help. And I was like, yeah, you're absolutely right, you know, let's go. And we didn't know what we were going to do. And first we thought we were just going to offer rides to people because we didn't realize how serious it was, or, you know, what happened. And we saw by and we asked all of these other people in the School of Public Health who you would think were trained in how to respond to this stuff. And I'm sure they are. But they were all, oh, no, we'd be in the way, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, do you see any police cars down there? Do you see any ambulances down there? There's nothing. And so, I mean, we headed down there, and by the time we got there, there were a lot of other people who had already responded and, you know, pulling kids out of the bus and were doing all this stuff. And, you know, we were just there to kind of help, and there was a lot of these kids that already gotten off the bus. I didn't pull them out, or it wasn't anything like that. They were just sitting there, you know, and they're all very scared. Some of them were crying. Some of them were hurt. And so I just let them use my cell phone to call home, and they did. And, you know, it was very, very emotional, and the parents were scared. kids were scared. And then I think a semi caught fire, and they all started running. We had to try and collect them all. And then eventually the Red Cross building is right there, by the way, right across from our building. But they weren't open for some reason. I think it was after 5. Finally, somebody came out or whatever, and then we put all the kids in that section. That way they didn't get lost or stolen or, you know, whatever. And then we just help people, you know, connect kids with the parents and stuff like that, and try and point out who was really sick or really injured versus people who were okay and things like that. And it was really intense. And my boss was also, or not my boss anymore, but the one when it happened, she was American Indian too. And I don't know, I thought maybe it was an American Indian white people thing where who responds and who doesn't, because we might have more of a sense of community. But I also remember my boss grew up in a smaller town too. So it might be a small town, big city thing, with who would respond and who wouldn't. But in any case, it was really intense. It was really scary. But I usually do whatever I have to do, and then I freak out later, and that's kind of what happened. Like, I got shaky after it was all over with.
Well, it's interesting to me, Isaiah, that you were drawn to the children. This seems to be you value them, and there's a quote here in an article written about you about this incident that where you say, the children, I will never forget the fear and the terror and the emotions I saw on their faces that day. It had to be an incredibly powerful experience. Were you actually trying to get them off the bus too, or were you taking care of them on the side? How was that?
They had already gotten off the bus. Somebody else had gotten them off the bus. They were kind of gathered on the... There's like the side, there's the street, and then the sidewalk, and then there's like this grassy area. That's where they were all sitting. And so we were just walking along and trying to assess who was really injured and if people wanted to call home. And it was intense. Like, they were scared. And once they got a hold of their parents, sometimes that made it worse. Like, they just started crying and crying and crying. And you could just sense the fear in their faces. And you didn't really know how to help. Like, you know, I didn't know what to say. I just kind of like, you know, it's going to be okay, you're all right, you know, it's going to be fine, and you know, I don't know that, but you just tell them that, because you just don't know, and I think...
And these children had just seen the semi-truck explode next to the bus, or at least very near it, and did the bus catch fire also? The bus burned
that,
also?
I don't know, I could just see the smoke. I couldn't actually see if the bus caught fire. But it was... It's intense. And I guess, I don't know if this is why I think maybe I focused on them. Well, one, it was, they were, like, vulnerable population that, you know, the adults who were injured, they, you know, could take care of themselves, and they could tell you they're injured, but the kids, you don't know, and they're kind of all running around, and there was only, like, I think 4 of us that were there kind of hurting them. Not hurting them, but hurting them.
Okay,
so,
yeah. On radio, you have to clarify that, exactly.
I think one of the things that I remember is the word in Lakota for children is the same word for holy. Like, Wakan is the word for holy, and Wakan is the word for children. It's the same word, because we believe children are sacred. And,
well, this
and
is also
that.
A... Please go ahead.
Go ahead.
No,
I don't
I was,
know if
I was
that's
about...
why.
Yeah?
I don't know if that's why, but I think that plays an important role, or at least I think about that, too. And valuing children is important.
Well, this is very interesting, too, because in some of the reading I've done about you today, that phrase, the children are holy, that it extends to the fact that you don't hit children. Is this true?
Yes, you're not supposed to hit children ever, ever. But I think in our culture, we have some higher, I don't know how it compares to other communities, but we have high instances of child abuse. I think any instance of child abuse is too high, but, you know, I think it's higher than maybe the average. And I think a lot of that has to do with generational trauma. And what happens is the whole generation, sometimes 2 generations, were taken out of the way they were taught, and they're put in boarding schools where it was like corporal punishment and, you know, your stereotypical scary nun with the ruler type thing, and people beating children, and children in the boarding schools are sexually abused, physically abused, a lot of them died, almost half some died in some areas. And so that you have a complete loss of their culture where the children are sacred. And then I think some of them fundamentally know that. But, you know, growing up for whatever, spending whatever 12 years of your life, or it probably was 8, because I think they only got 8th grade education, but 8 years of your life, you're socialized to have some beliefs no matter what happens when you come back. You know, it's not going to be the same. And because of that, then they sometimes don't know how to raise their children, and it kind of keeps, like, dominoing. And I think that's why you see some of, so much of, you know, the problems that our community has with overeating and suicide and drug and alcohol addiction or gambling addiction and child abuse, all of those things. You'll see them a lot in communities that are impoverished as well. But, yeah, you're never supposed to hit a child, and many traditional families would never see that happen.
This is interesting when you compare it to, for instance, the James Dobsons of the world who wrote a parenting book saying that you should, whenever you spank or paddle your children, you should always do it to make sure that they cry. This is such a radical departure. Christianity has become so mean-spirited. Now, let me explain. I go to a Methodist church, and I also go to another church in the evening that I'm involved in, and all that, but, you know, but it's from some of these right-wing, it's just mean-spirited.
And I think some of that, I think, comes from maybe the Puritan work ethic, or the Puritan idea of what's right and wrong. And I think what people forget, Christianity coming here and missionizing people is very patriarchal or paternalistic, sorry, type of idea. And I think religion at its best is about you and your personal relationship. That sounds so evangelical. You and your personal relationship with your higher power. And community gathering together is about, like, you have individual prayer and worship, and you have corporate prayer and worship, where you gather as a community. And it's about the gathered community that's important. It's not about making sure the gathered community all think exactly the same. It's that the gathered community trying to accomplish good things or doing good works or taking care of itself together as a community.
I see. I have to ask you about this thing in the news. You rocked my world today. I asked you about the Lakota tribes and you, going for sovereignty, and you put an entirely different. Please tell that story to the listeners. I don't think any of us know this.
Well, I mean, I think the headlines are very big, and, you know, yellow journalism. You know, they want something sensational and very exciting. And the truth is that it wasn't the tribal chair people who went down, and the tribal presidents, you know, or whatever, they didn't go down to Washington, D.C. and say, we are now hereby withdrawing. It was a group of individuals who do not have the authority, I guess, to do that. It would be, well, just like you and I saying, you know, the United States hereby, da 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 da, you know, or whatever. We can speak for ourselves. We can't speak on behalf of the whole United States. And I think Russell Means, forgive me if I get the name wrong. Mr. Means, along with a few other people, they are very intent, and I think they have the best intentions in their heart. Their goal is, I don't know what their overarching goal is. If they really wanted to withdraw, if they wanted to create awareness, because I, you know, everybody heard about it, and so that creates awareness that, you know, we still have great health disparities between American Indians and the rest of the population, and we still have, problems, and treaties still aren't being followed, and very intense things. And one thing, I guess, to kind of maybe put a light on it, more money is spent by the federal government per person on prison health, on health care for people in prison, than is spent on American Indians for health care. And it's not that people in prison don't deserve excellent health care, because they do, but they spend almost twice as much per person than they do on American Indians, even though they have a responsibility, a responsibility to provide health care to all American Indians. And those are the kind of things that really make one upset, and those are the kind of things that, I guess, Mr. Means is really angry, and I am too. I think maybe he just has a different idea of it, of how to go about doing it. And some of the tribes responded that they're only thinking about what he said. They're not actually going to do anything about it. And also, you didn't see a government respond. Like, you didn't see our government respond.
I see. Well, one good thing that's come out of it all is that we met you. I mean, I've got to say, I've hung on every word you've said. It. I can't remember paying more attention to a guest that I've paid to you. There are just so many things of interest here, things that we never know. I mean, we all know the news about, you know, gay bashings and what's coming out of the fundamentalist movement and what Huckabee is saying. We do those things every day, and it's so refreshing to hear you know, a totally different point of view. Isaiah, tell us about these, and I wasn't aware of this until I read about it today, Native American gay and lesbian gatherings. Apparently there have been several, Two Spirits and something about Winnipeg. Do you know about those? What is that about?
I know about them, but I've never actually attended one. I've attended smaller ones that happen in, like, the cities. Usually in cities you'll either meet the other Indians in the gay community, or you meet them in the Indian community. But then there are gatherings, and everybody gets together, and you just meet and talk and share. And I think a lot of times, you know, if I find another gay Indian, it's very helpful, especially if it's in my tribe, just to be able to share stories or experience another person who has a similar life to your own. You find a lot of times, like, when I talk about the gay community before, it gets really frustrating, and I've had people say all sorts of awful things, you know, and they think they're being nice, or they try and hit on you, and you end up having to give a workshop every 5 minutes because, no, you're not going to dress up like Pocahontas for Halloween, or no, you don't know a mating dance, or no, not every Indian has long hair, these kind of things. And sometimes it's nice just to be able to talk to somebody about those things, and they understand, and they also, you know, have a similar understanding of the role and how we're supposed to be. And so it frustrates them when they see, you know, gross commercialism or gross materialism or things that exist.
Could you tell us a little about the women in the traditional Lakota tribes? What was, you've mentioned that you had a, you know, you knew what your job was, or you knew where you fit in and what your role was and what you're supposed to do. Did lesbian women have that same sort of, how were they treated? How did that work?
That I don't know for sure. I wasn't taught to me because my grandparents and people didn't tell me because I'm not a lesbian. But I know that I have an aunt. She's a lesbian, and she is a spiritual, I don't want to call her a medicine woman, but she's a very spiritual individual, and she takes us on a leadership role in a lot of different senses. When my grandpa, who was an Episcopal priest, died, she helped us out a lot with the different things that we did, and she sang, and, you know, she does a lot of spiritual stuff, and she takes on that same kind of role where, you know, definitely community-minded, definitely community leadership. And I would like to say that transgender people, as it was taught to me, they're actually not, I don't want to say they're not special because everyone's special, but they actually were, whatever gender they identified as, that was their gender. They didn't have, like, if they wanted to have that unique role, they could be Wink Day also. But first and foremost, they were whatever gender they identified as. So if they were a woman, they were a woman. If they felt like a man, they were a man. Whereas Wink Day, they could be in that in-between space. And so if you're transgender, you would have to be in the other space. So if I was born, if I had a penis, we'll say maybe, and I acted like a woman, dressed like a woman, I could dance like a woman, all of those things, you can do all of those things, but then you have to be in that role of a woman's role. You wouldn't be in the Wink Day role.
I see. So there's sub-variations. It's all very subtle. It just blows me away. Just amazing. I want to ask you, well, there is a question from production chat I need to ask you. How does being a non-straight Lakota, How does that affect your interactions, say, with the tribal unit, maybe tribal government or tribal, you know, leadership? Is there a difference in the way you're treated there? I understand the family part, but how about the tribal unit as a whole?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't really interact with the tribal government very often, except I have my tribal ID, and I think what I've noticed, at least, is, and I think they both have the best intentions, but a lot of people who are in tribal politics, their goal, I think, originally was to create policy-wide changes, and that's how they're going to help the tribe, and they do it. But then, you know, to stay in power, they have to do different things and kind of sell out, or, you know, people have that perception, and so a lot of people don't like to deal with politics at all on the tribe. Like, they might vote for somebody, but, you know, they don't want to have to try and fight that. They would rather just do good in their thing. Like, I'm just going to work with battered women, or I'm just going to be the best teacher I can be, or I'm going to be the best youth worker I can be. You see that, and they'll do that. And I'm one of those, I think, because I see, you know, if you look at some different tribes, you know, the Pine Ridge, they have all these, you know, dramas in their tribal government, and I'm sure Rosewood has theirs, and you know, it's all very, I guess that's kind of how I can explain it. When I'm in communities of Indians, I guess, I've never had problems. Like I said, I can speak my mind, I'm listened to. Sometimes I don't want to say what I have to say is given more weight than others, because I think everybody's given equal weight, but I think sometimes maybe what I have to say is, I don't know, I may not have a lot of official authority, but I definitely have cachet or something. I don't know what the word is.
Well said. You're a force to be reckoned with. You had mentioned your uncle in the Episcopal Church. Now, that would make you his nephew, if I understand this. And apparently he is a father. So is he a priest in the Episcopal Church?
My grandfather was a priest, and my uncle is,
oh,
yeah.
I see. Well, that's very interesting. So the whole family then, or at least for several generations of it, are very involved in the Episcopal Church.
Yeah.
It must be very encouraging to see what the Episcopal Church is doing and standing up to you've got Desmond Tutu, you know, writing an apology to the LGBT community. I don't know if you saw it. It was just recently he actually wrote a touching apology to, you know, about what the church has done. And you have people like that, and then you have the people like the Uganda bishop who's raising sand, and then you've got the bishops over here of the Episcopal Church standing up to all that. You must be very proud of them.
Well, I don't know. I think proud is not the word I would use. I think we have an understanding of the scripture a certain way, and our culture says a certain thing, and the Bible itself was written in a particular culture, one that didn't value women and one that didn't believe slavery was bad. And I think we need to be, we need to be understanding of the people in Africa, I think, to some extent, because some of their seminary education is the equivalent of what we would get, maybe, this is going to sound way bad, but like in Sunday school, it's a very small amount. Where, you know, our priests are generally trained for 3 years in a grad school education. And a lot of times the seminaries in Africa, they're getting books that are from the 50s because they're using our old textbooks. And so it's going to take them a little while to come along, I think. And if they were to reach deep down in their roots, I think they, in their traditional indigenous cultures, they would find that they had link days too. They would probably call them something else and they might have a slightly different role, but I promise you they have them there.
That's a very interesting take. Now, time grows short. I must tell you, you have been an absolutely fabulous guest. I would love to have you back and at some point in the future. And even without a scheduled comeback date, you're very welcome to phone this program at any time. I'll put you on and if you've got things to say. And, in fact, right now, without me directing questions out you, you know, I've been bombarding you left and right. If there's anything you'd like to say without, you know, me, you know, I might have been going in all the wrong directions. If there's anything that you'd like to just say on your own, you're welcome to without me prodding.
I don't know. I don't know what I would say.
Well, I've got to tell you, everything that you have said has been brilliant. And I by tomorrow morning at some point in the morning, I will send you a link to the audio archive. The audio archives will appear at the Strictly Confidential Radio website over the next couple of days. We're just having a problem with the host. We can't post to it right now, but I can send you a direct link. And you're welcome to edit or use the archive in any way you wish. And I am so appreciative of your being on the show. I can't begin to tell you, you are truly a marvelous guest, Isaiah.
Awesome. Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
I'm so glad. And God bless, and I hope to talk to you again soon. Good evening to you.
Good evening.
And that, my friends, was Isaiah Brokenleg. That is a perspective. Wasn't that the most refreshing thing you've heard in a long time? Such a spirit of inclusiveness, that family means their word for it, which I again won't attempt to pronounce. Their word for it means all my relatives, but in their sense, all my relatives includes all humans, all plants, all animals, and all inanimate objects. My God, has Christianity fallen short or what? We ever recover from this morass? I don't know. But God, I hope we do. Maybe we can take a lesson from these people. If we get Isaiah back, we'll try and ask him about how things are in other tribes. He talked specifically about the Lakota. So, well, I'm so blessed to be able to do this show. So, in closing, let's see. There will not be a horn section tonight. John is still having some connection problems, and I think John will be back with us at the beginning of the year. So, Bob and I are not going to do a horn section. There will not be a John all foxed up show this evening. It will be a replay. It will carry. It'll just be a replay. And let's see. Okay, I talked about the website. Can't update that. And oh yes, please stop by the Head On Radio Network site. To make a donation if you can. And so in closing, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you too.
This is the Quality News Network. Rescue efforts resume in rural southwest Washington state today, where flooding has forced hundreds from their homes that are currently underwater. More than 100,000 people are without power. The good news, it has stopped raining for now. In Oregon, National Guard troops evacuated the town of Vernonia in rafts. The storm that hit the Northwest Monday left 5 people dead in Oregon and Washington. Progress is slow at the climate meeting in Bali. The 190-nation gathering about global warming took small steps today toward curbing greenhouse gas emissions, especially in China and India. President Bush claims he'll veto a new congressional law toughening fuel standards for cars. It is the first change in fuel standards in 30 years. The legislation is designed to decrease greenhouse gas emissions, and increase fuel efficiency. The president held a news conference today and said Iran is still a danger, despite a new U.S. intelligence report that says Tehran's nuclear weaponry program was halted 4 years ago and remains on hold. Iran's foreign minister responded to the report yesterday and said they welcome the correction by the U.S. intelligence, although the report cautioned that Iran is still enriching uranium. U.S. nuclear negotiator Christopher Hill is meeting with his North Korean counterpart today. Yesterday, Hill became the highest-ranking American to visit Pyongyang's reactor. 5 National Guard brigades, about 15,000 soldiers, have been called up for combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, scheduled to start in the summer of 2009. North of Baghdad, the U.S. military says soldiers accidentally killed one civilian and wounded 3 yesterday. American troops opened fire on a vehicle, slow to stop at a roadblock. The British schoolteacher imprisoned in Sudan for violating Islamic law has arrived in London. She was pardoned by Sudan's president after serving half of her 2-week sentence. Former Democratic fundraiser Norman Shue was formally charged today in a 15-count indictment for engaging